from high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. It's been a busy week. Keep in mind, if you ever have to leave your local affiliate and you want to continue to listen to the show, just go to the Fox News app, click on the headset you want to watch, and click on watch, and then swipe until you get to the show, because we stream on Fox Nation. This hour, we're going to be joined by Mike Pompeo in a matter of moments, and we'll be taking your phone calls, too. We have a lot going on. We know the President of the United States is going to be meeting with a speaker today over in Mar-a-Lago. But first, there could be FISA rules amended and passed for a two-year deal sometime this morning. So we're following all of this, and this at 4:30 this afternoon is when the Trump Speaker Johnson press conference will be held. Very interesting. They're going to focus on election integrity. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's big three.
Number three.
And then the Mueller report came out, and no collusion. And, you know, I think we sort of went to sort of the story kind of disappeared. You know, despite our feelings about Trump, this is a story we should have sort of treated differently.
You think so? Yuri Berliner, the NPR 25-year editor, who just came out in a free press story, and then later on with Barry Weiss, talk about what's happening at NPR, that even though he's a Democrat that would never vote for Trump, he could not believe the biasness that has taken place with his organization. And now there's some blowback. Is he going to lose his job, or will things change with a new CEO?
Number two.
Our most immediate concern has been that individuals or small groups will draw some kind of twisted inspiration from the events in the Middle East to carry out attacks here at home.
That is the FBI director. Get it together. Terror challenges everywhere. Thanks to the terror den we repopulated when we left Afghanistan, as the distrust grows between Americans, Congress, and the FBI. Meanwhile, regional war looms as Iran prepares to directly hit Israel in 48 hours. We'll talk to Secretary of State Pompeo about that.
Number one.
Can somebody explain to me in crayon eating terms why I make over three times the federal minimum wage and I cannot afford to live? And I do not want to hear the pull yourself up from your bootstraps, work 90 hours a week.
Nick Summers, a TikTok guy who didn't go to college, outraged that all everyone else getting their loan forgiven. He says he couldn't afford it, works as a mechanic, and was just on with us. He first posted on TikTok and just joined us on Fox and Friends to talk about what his life is like and why is that. Well, on normal economic terms, forget about macroeconomics, GDP, or anything else. If you look up and down, credit card debt in this country has risen 46% in 3 years. Do you know the cost per pound of things like flour up 24%, bread up 29%, butter 23%, steak 28%. And if 60% of the country are living a paycheck to paycheck, that's a big deal. And you want to talk about policies and abortion bans, if you really want to hurt the American people or help them, fix inflation. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo doesn't do that, but fixes everything else. He's former Secretary of State and CIA director, best-selling author. Mr. Secretary, welcome back.
Brian, great to be with you. We can fix inflation too. Good election in November, and we'll be on our way.
And you got that West Point education. They don't just let you focus on the military. You do have to take economics courses. So Mike, first off, I got to ask you about the Iranians and our intelligence that says that within 48 hours they want to directly hit Israel. General Jack Keane says, I don't think so. He goes, they're vulnerable. You know, they got drones. Yeah. But they are not impenetrable, and they know they'll pay a heavy price if they directly hit Israel. What do you think?
Well, first, I think the Iranians will take some kind of response. I don't know what it'll be. I don't know if it'll be inside of Israel or, frankly, Brian, more likely, maybe this is what John Keane was speaking to, an Israeli target somewhere else in the world. You could imagine one in Europe. Given what's going on our southern border, who knows, maybe here. We ought to take seriously the threats that they have made. Israel's pretty capable of defending itself from drones and missiles. None of us can stop them all, so I suppose it's possible for them to penetrate that. But the larger point is this. We've lost deterrence in the Middle East. It's come unhinged from October 7th to the hundreds of attacks against American interests in the region since October 7th. The Iranians no longer fear us, and our Gulf Arab ally friends are very worried about American weakness in the region, and that portends bad things for our young men and women. who have had to go fight and risk their lives there too many times. We need to get this deterrence back. I think it's going to take new leadership.
You think? No doubt about it. Do you think Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan are up to this job? Do you think that Lloyd Austin has shown that he's got the compunction to assert himself? Do you think President Biden is doing anything but reacting? When's the last time, Mr. Secretary, you even heard him call out Iran for the chaos they've created?
You know, Brian, I would add to that. It's been a long time, even more than that. When's the last time he's spoken at length about the fact that we have Americans being held by the Iranians in Gaza? You can call it Hamas, but in the end, you and I both know that the progenitor of this problem set is the Iranians. He just doesn't talk about these things. He wants to still get back into some silly nuclear deal while Iran is literally on the cusp of having enough enriched uranium to build multiple weapons. Truly dangerous. When everything you do, you're afraid you're going to escalate, and that you're focused on collecting votes in Dearborn, Michigan, instead of keeping our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines safe. That is a real risk to the United States of America, Brian.
Well, I'll tell you what. Netanyahu was standing in front of an F-15, and he said, "If they hit us, if they hurt us, we will hurt them twice as hard." On some level, and you understand the military mindset. If you have three enemies and they continue to take shots at you daily, and now that your country is finally in a war footing, is there a part of the Israeli military mindset that thinks, let's get this over with, because it's only going to get harder if we leave Hezbollah, Hamas, and don't show Iran what they would face if they take us on?
Brian, undoubtedly. I think the Israeli leadership knows that the destruction of Hamas is necessary, and they're going to continue it. But I think they also know while it's necessary, it's not sufficient. Still, Brian, you still have between 80 and 100,000 Israelis. They can't go back to their homes because Hezbollah now is firing rockets into the northern part of their country. We'd never tolerate that. At least we'd never tolerate that if we had a president who had the capacity to defend America. We'd never tolerate firing missiles onto our property and causing 100,000 people have to move out of Florida or New York or California. And yet that's the situation they face. So I suspect there are military leaders saying, let's go clean this up. There's no going back to October 6th. I'm sure there will be those in the world who will criticize us for us. But in the end, our responsibility is to keep our people safe. They want to put Israel first the same way the Trump administration put our country first. I frankly hope that they'll get that right.
So it's been fascinating, and I got so sick of hearing the American press outside this station. I went to Israeli news, just local news, and I went on YouTube, and I just watched to see how they were covering this. And there is such, I would say, hurt and shock about President Biden's stance about the war in Gaza. They don't come out and say he's terrible and incompetent, but they say, once again, his statement, and they roll it in, and they can't believe it. It's as if they said America forgot how this whole thing started. Now, we have always, other administrations have had friction with Israel. That's not unusual. But this is another level. Don't you agree?
Complete another level. When you have the United States Secretary of State talk about the moral equivalence, the fact that it may become indistinguishable between Hamas and Israel, that train has left the station. And what I mean by that is the leadership of Hamas and Iran sees that and says, green light. Opportunity in front of us. The American leadership is weak, and we're going to go extract as much as we can from Israel while this president is still in office. It's unlike anything I've seen before. Your point about friction, we were as close to Israel as probably any administration in the last 50 years, but we had our moments too. That's natural. But this administration has chosen to part with our friend, our ally. They are no longer sufficiently supportive of the rightful Jewish homeland of the people to live in this place. And you've seen what they've done on BDS. I mean, the list is long, what they did at the United Nations. We should stand shoulder to shoulder with Israeli people while they're trying to defend their nation from the terrorists that put their home in Tehran.
And by the way, they cannot, there's no question they have to go into Rafah, correct? General Keane said you just got to give a passageway to get some civilians out, but they cannot possibly not go in there.
They'll go to Rafah. They'll go to Rafah. They've got to eliminate this threat. You can't stop short. Victory has to be achieved. They have to win, and they have to have a security system, a security architecture. Whenever they call done, they've got to have a security architecture that provides real security for their own people from Gaza.
I'm sure you've seen the debate on Capitol Hill and the distrust with Christopher Wray, especially amongst Republicans. When you think about McCabe, when you think about Strzok, you think about Page. That didn't happen under him, but there's still members of the FBI and people were working to hurt you guys for 4 years. It has been more apparent almost every day. And here's Christopher Wray going to bat for some of the surveillance tools he used, some of which were abused. But first, here's his plea yesterday to Congress. Cut 12.
Section 702 is indispensable in keeping Americans safe from a whole barrage of fast-moving foreign threats. It is crucial to identifying terrorists in the homeland, working with or inspired by a rogues gallery of foreign terrorist organizations who have publicly called for attacks against our country.
Is he right?
Brian, he's right. But with that awesome power comes a responsibility to clean your stuff up, to when someone breaks the rules, whether it's Section 702 or, you know, warrant requirements, whatever it is that the FBI is doing to, you know, execute its duty to keep us safe. You've got to hold people accountable, and that's the failure. And that's why you see this distrust. Section 702 is important. I saw it as a CIA director. It saved American lives with absolute certainty to figure out where these bad guys are talking from, what they're doing. Communicating back here into the United States to people they've now infiltrated inside of our country is an absolutely vital tool. And, you know, I've not seen the reforms that have been put in place. They're good. There's now bigger criminal penalties. Mm-hmm. They've cut down on the number of people who can have access to this information. So it's better. You know, it'll never be perfect, Brian. There's always going to be bad actors in the world. But when that happens, you have to crush them. You have to put them in jail for what they did. When they violate U.S. law and the privacy rights of the American people, they have to be held accountable. I hope we'll keep 702, and I hope we'll keep FBI agents doing what they're supposed to do, not what Jim Comey had them doing against our administration.
Right. And Christopher Wray tried to clean that up, but he has not regained the trust, and no one's really been fired. In fact, they all end up with MSNBC and CNN contracts. Here's Christopher Wray on the plethora of attacks and things that are keeping him up at night. Cut 11.
You've got Hezbollah expressing support and praise for Hamas and threatening to attack U.S. interests in the region. You've got Al-Qaeda issuing its most specific call for an attack against us, against the U.S. in the last 5 years. You've got AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, calling for jihadists to attack Americans and Jewish communities in the U.S. You've got ISIS urging its followers repeatedly to attack Jewish communities in the U.S.
And he was just rattling them off. I don't think he's not much of an exaggerator. Do you think, what do you think his clipboard looks like?
He said, I think the last time he testified that this is his, you know, a red light as he has ever seen. I agree. Director Wray's not much of an exaggerator. He's seeing all this. I can't believe he's not. Maybe he is in the Situation Room looking at Mayorkas saying, you got to shut this border down. You're going to get Americans killed. All of the things he highlighted there, whether it was Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or Hezbollah, all of these things are exacerbated, Brian, by the fact that we now have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in our country, and we have no idea who they are, where they came from, or what their intentions are that they are here now. It has to be keeping lots of senior FBI law enforcement people from Milwaukee to Sacramento to Austin, Texas. It has to be keeping them just on their toes, trying to figure out how do we track all this malfeasance, all this risk inside of our country when we've got this enormously porous southern border. It's a challenging time for Director Wray.
I know what you want, but as an analyst, which you are, what do you think President Trump's chances of winning in November are right now?
I think really good. And I think the chances are really good, not because of some poll data that I have seen, but because as I travel around the country to talk to people from all stripes, they are struggling to figure out how to pay their rent, keep their mortgage current, and take care of their families and kids. They see this. We talk about it as inflation, as it's this big thing, but it's what it costs to fill the tank of gas. It's what it costs to put scrambled eggs in your kid's breakfast or bologna on your kid's sandwich. These are the things that the American people are struggling with today. And I think when a push comes to shove in November, they may see noise from President Trump, but they're going to see the signal that Americans can return to a better time and their lives can be better. And I think in the end, in the the seven states that will make the difference in the Electoral College, I think President Trump wins nearly all of them.
Would you join his administration if he wins?
Brian, I've been asked this a couple times. My answer is always the same. If I can serve and help and have an impact, sign me up. No one's asked me. I've had no job offered to me. But if I can help the United States and the American people deliver good outcomes, sign me up.
Oh, you can stay with us, too. We're not bad.
not bad at all, Brian.
All right. Mr. Secretary, thanks so much. Mike Pompeo, great start.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll take your calls when we come back. I also want you to hear the exchange yesterday between Christopher Wray and a congressman from California. Wow. Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Can I just get a simple yes or no response to this question? Does the open border policy make your job easier or harder? Are we safer or less safe as a result of the open border policy?
I have been consistent over the years, frankly, in citing my concerns about the threats that emanate from the border.
Okay.
And as to the long narrative that you went through at the beginning, needless to say, I disagree very strongly with any number of aspects of it.
Congressman Garcia, some of the exchange yesterday basically looked at Chris Wray at one point and said, I don't believe anything you're saying. I mean, it's just such a bad point, America. When the FBI director, they could just accuse him of lying. It's not James Comey. And it's not saying I did this or this to Donald Trump. They're talking about his ability to create havoc and make sure Biden reinforces the border. He doesn't feel as though he's doing that. Or that he's fully straightened out the FBI. Joel, listening in Naples, Florida. Hey, Joel.
Hi, Brian. I have a question. It seems like Israel almost knows where the hostages are and where Hamas is hanging out. And I just wanted to mention that. Do you think they really know where they're at, but they just can't get in because it's Rafah?
My hunch is yes, but then again, would I ever think that their intelligence was so bad to allow these October 7th to happen? My sense is yes. I mean, the fact is they provided video. As soon as they pulled out of the south, do you know rockets started going off again with Hamas? But they provided video, so they knew exactly where those rockets are coming from. Are they going to be destroyed today? I don't know. They know roughly, I think, where he is, because I was watching some videos of captured Hamas fighters, not under duress. And they were talking about where everyone is and for the Israeli public. So do I think that they have a way of getting information? Yes. You know, Joe, you made me think I should get that son of Hamas guy, Mossab, on again and maybe answer that question for you. Listen, I'll be able to take some questions the rest of the hour, take some calls, I should say. I'm also going to bring up more of this heated exchange between Mike Garcia and the FBI director, who seems kind of unflappable. Also, more on this UPI story.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Can somebody explain to me in crayon eating terms why I make over three times the federal minimum wage and I cannot afford to live? And I do not want to hear the pull yourself up from your bootstraps, work 90 hours a week. That's not the goal, guys!
So that is a ranter on TikTok that we interviewed this morning. And he works, he said, I couldn't afford college. Although anyone could afford college, you can go to a junior college school, you can pay it off gradually. That they're very, it's very affordable. But he didn't want to go to college, so he started working for a car service. It looks like he might be a mechanic, and he says he's working double minimum wage, which makes sense because you can't find mechanics. Double minimum wage. He lives by himself, and he can't afford a two room or a one bedroom apartment. He lives over in Virginia, and then it just outraged him after talking to him that Joe Biden did it again. He is now forgiven more student loan debt. He's now up to $7.48 billion in student loan debt. And he says between that and the illegal immigrants they were giving full room and board to, and now debit cards in New York. He has had it. He said, what about America First? But wouldn't reveal who he's voting for. Ben Dominis joins us now, editor-at-large for the Spectator World, Fox News contributor. He's got the Ben Dominis podcast. Ben, have you heard that sentiment for this next generation?
I absolutely have. I mean, I've heard it all over the place. And you know, it's funny. I have a lot of friends who are in the same category. They either, you know, did some college, or junior college, community college, that kind of thing. And then they went into the trade space. And what they really tell me is that, you know, this is it's an incredible challenge, because at this moment, you know, those sort of skilled jobs, those manual labor jobs, are actually in huge demand, and they can't find people who are willing to do them in a lot of cases, because they, you know, have so much, frankly, largesse, welfare, et cetera, that is being thrown at them by this administration, and that has been thrown at them ever since the beginning of COVID, really, that they, you know, basically are not willing to come out and work. And then, you know, in terms of that, it means that they can't take on as many projects as they want. They can't take on, you know, as many things as they want that actually have people working a job that that pays them enough to have the ability to live the way that they want to. It's easier for them to not work and to live off of the taxpayer dime than it is for them to work and find themselves shorter and shorter when it comes to the end of the month. And that's something that I just think is absolutely underrated in terms of what's driving the popularity of former President Trump, because this is the thing that people don't seem to understand is that the shift that has happened is something we have not seen in decades in politics. You have to go back to 84 and Reagan in terms of the level of shift that we've seen among the hard hat working class community of Black and Hispanic men in particular, who are coming back around to support Donald Trump. It's because they're the ones who were hit by this White House. And this White House, if you look at their priorities, if you look at the issues that they're talking about, it essentially comes down to Hamas has a right to exist and babies don't. And that's the sort of thing that they are saying over and over again, week after week. And who does that appeal to? That's suburban voters, that's you know, upper educated voters, and it's angry college students. It's not the kind of people who actually work with their hands.
Well, 60% of the people listening to us right now live paycheck to paycheck in America. So when you have cost per pound of flour up 24%, of bread up 29% since Joe Biden took office, spaghetti and macaroni 8.4%, butter 23%. Why? How is that? So get this: eggs 104%.
You know, and I'll tell you this, Brian, my daughters are 3 and 1. When you have kids, when you have especially young kids, you go to the grocery a lot more than you do you've got older kids and you've got, you know, or if you're childless. One of the big shifts that we've actually noticed, the economists pointed this out, is that the people who have shifted there's a vast overrepresentation of young school age kids in terms of parents of those young kids that shifted. Why? Because they see those prices. They see those eggs prices and those butter prices and those milk prices every single time that they go to the grocery store. And they say, what the heck is going on here? Because you feel it so much more intensely if you have that experience. And that's what I think is driving this. And the White House doesn't care. They just don't care about it. They're pretending like it isn't happening. And I think that they're in for a really rude awakening, because I think those poll numbers are not going to shift the way that they expect. They expect that, you know, the typical Democratic machine will be able to pull Black and Hispanic voters back in their direction. I don't think it's going to work this time.
So people don't need to see this, but if you want to picture this, see, people say, well, you know, inflation was skyrocketing. Well, when we took over, it was at 9%. And now it's just rising at 2%. So picture this. Picture a bar graph and it's a 9. All right. And then picture adding the 2 on top of the 9, not instead of the 9, because it's only growing slower, but it is still growing.
It's getting worse more slowly than it used to be.
So this is why President Biden said this yesterday. This is just an outright lie. Cut 2.
Well, I do stand by my prediction that before the year is out, there'll be a rate cut. This may delay it a month or so. I'm not sure of that. We don't know what the Fed is going to do for certain. But look, we have dramatically reduced inflation from 9% down to close to 3%. We're in a situation where we're better situated than we were when we took office. where inflation was skyrocketing, and we have a plan to deal with it.
It was not skyrocketing. Do you really think he's selling people on that?
I don't think that that solves the problem for any, you know, mom or dad who just came back from the grocery store.
It's not true.
It's like I'm buying the same things that I was, you know, 2-3 years ago, and I'm breaking $100 to do it, where, you know, before it was 60. You know, it's just something that I think is incredible in terms of how out of touch it sounds. It's like he's making a case that is meant for the MSNBC audience, for the same people who, again, you know, it's like they have these priorities that are just completely out of touch with the priorities of the vast majority of Americans. And I think that, you know, it's the same kind of obliviousness that they had on the border, in the sense that they just pretend like it's not an issue. It's not an issue. It's not an issue. It's not an issue. If I were Democrats, the smartest thing that they could do going into this election would have been to get rid of Secretary Mayorkas, to just say to this impeachment inquiry, you know, this whole effort, you know, forget about it. We're just going to replace him. Okay. Because at least then they could point to something and say, hey, look, things need to improve. We're turning things around. We've got a new guy in there, whoever that new guy is. Mm-hmm. And maybe it wouldn't actually work, because I think their policies wouldn't change, but they could at least point to something like, hey, we hear you. We hear that this is a problem. We're going to take a new direction, have some guy who looks tougher on camera, and that kind of thing. But they don't. They just are completely oblivious about what people care about.
Right. They don't replace anyone unless they cross-dress and steal luggage with a mustache. besides
even that.
That
took a while.
Right. Even that took a while. And plus, can you imagine, Ben, your company, if your staff at lunchtime protested against you? He has people protesting in mass from his own staff.
It's
pro-Israel.
I mean, it's the inmates running the asylum. Yes. It's, I mean, the thing that is, first off, if that happened under any responsible administration, those people would come back to their desk from that lunch break and find a pink slip. You're done. Okay. This is over. That's fine. You want to go protest? Do it on your own time and find somebody else to fund it for you. It's not something that I think is acceptable by any means, but it also is indicative of the kind of people that are within this administration that they have chosen to hire, and that come from within this, frankly, crazy group of young Democrats who are completely opposed to supporting Israel in any real way. I don't buy for one second that it's about some sophisticated political, ideological break with Benjamin Netanyahu. It's just opposition to Israel and our allies. And I think that that's something that's been true, frankly, ever since day one of this Biden administration.
So I want to talk about the possibility of getting a debate together. President Trump really wants to do it, but he wants to do it earlier. Even though Ronald McDaniel's RNC walked away from the Council on Debates,
the Presidential Commission,
it looks like the president's still reaching out to him. The co-chair, Frank Farrenkopf, and Antonio Hernandez, and Susie Wiles and LaCavita are all talking about doing this, and they all agree there should be a debate. They're asking for it earlier because of early voting. No response yet from the White House. In your prediction, Ben Domenech, do you believe there'll be a debate?
I believe there will be a debate. I believe there will be one debate. And I think the reason that there will be one is because the Biden White House is not going to be able to avoid the fact that there are a lot of people in Biden's camp who think that he does well when he gets out on camera and proves to people that he's capable of just standing up and talking for a certain amount of time. You know, that was the attitude that they had about the State of the Union. I think when it comes to this, if he was ahead by any significant amount consistently in polling averages and the like, then I think the answer would be no, there would be no debates, but he's not. And so they, I think, need to, you know, at least entertain the possibility internally. And I think that once that starts to be entertained, they'll say, you know what, we can get on stage with Donald Trump for you know, 90 minutes, and we can show that Joe Biden can still hack it. But I think that if that happens, I think it'll be a huge mistake for them, because I think that if anything, you know, the former president has shown himself to be, I think, you know, an incredibly, you know, capable, figure on the debate stage when he is on offense, and he will come on offense. And I think that that's something that, you know, will frankly disrupt them a lot more. I think that the debate cycle that we had in 20 was not representative at all. We didn't even get a foreign policy debate because of all that mishigas. And he did the first debate, you know, frankly, you know, as we know now, probably suffering from the effects of COVID. So
oh, yeah.
It's one of these things, you know, that I think we'll actually get a chance to see these two guys on stage together. And I think that if that happens, I just don't think it's going to be close in terms of a comparison. I think it would be something that would hurt Biden a lot. But I think that they'll have to do it just because of the dynamic.
You just can't have a moderator working for the other guy again, like last time.
This is, look. This has been something I've been screaming about for 20 years. It is complete nonsense, okay, to have moderators who are essentially just tag-teaming with the Democratic nominee, as we've seen time and time again. It's just unacceptable. It's what the commission has put together time and time again. It's why Ronna broke with them. And I think that this is a situation where they are going to have to make sure that that's just not something that happens this time.
All right, so Fox did a poll. They asked people, is it important for the debate? Everybody was asked, they said extremely important, 64% said yes, 71% were Republicans, 60% said Democrats. Somewhat important, 35% all, 39 and 28. So it is extremely important to the American people to see a debate. Ben, I'm a little late, but I want you to hear this. This is my big worry. The FBI, Congress, and the American people on separate pages when we can't afford it. And I believe so many people agree with Congressman Mike Garcia. So this is what he said to Christopher Wray yesterday, Cut 13.
I'll be honest with you, and this pains me to say this, but I don't trust you. I don't think that this is necessarily a funding problem that we have for your agency as much as a leadership problem. And you have held no one truly accountable for prior FISA abuses that we have all seen and recognized. You've stood relatively silent and passive about the biggest national security threat to our nation, that being our very open southern border. I give very little credence in either your ability to do this job or, frankly, lead the brave agents below you. And I don't trust you to protect us.
So that's how the congressman from California feels. Do you think other people feel that way? Do you feel that way?
I do feel that way. I mean, I think that a lot of the American people feel that way. And I think that, you know, the lack of trust in the institution is at the core of all of these objections. It's what the Freedom Caucus is frankly hearing from their constituents, which is what is driving their resistance to this. Now, look, I've heard from Andy McCarthy and others the case to be made that this is something that's essential. And I certainly don't think that we can afford to be caught with, you know, and our hands tied when we are seeing so many threats around the world. But they are raising a valid point, which is that restoring trust in this agency isn't something that's going to happen overnight. It requires diligent leadership that acknowledges the problems that they've had, which I just don't think Christopher Wray has, and I don't think that this current leadership, you know, has either. So that's going to be a big challenge for the next president, and I hope that that president is willing to take on that challenge because it's something that's huge and important. We need to be able to trust the FBI. We can't just get rid of these institutions.
I know, because if somebody's doing something good, because we have not been having major attacks since 9/11,
yep.
And now we see we have a 5-alarm fire every day, though, and they've been saying that over and over again. All right, Ben, I know you're pumped up to do your podcast, the Ben Domenech Podcast. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All right. He's always great to talk to. So are you. 1-866-408-7669. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
He wouldn't have got off not if I was on that jury. There's no question about it. I mean, he was guilty as hell. The forensic evidence, the circumstantial evidence, and the manner in which the murders took place, it was clearly a crime of passion. And when you look at some of the things that they had articulated about his past, his relationship with Nicole Brown Simpson, some of the things that he had done to her, the Gloria Allreds and others obviously have spoken very eloquently about this over the years. It was clear that there was such a preponderance of evidence against him that, you know, he deserved to be in jail for the rest of his life at the very least.
But that wasn't the story. A lot of people in the black community back then were happy after Rodney King. They said this is balance. But O.J. lived a tortured life. I think he lost his mind. He was a little deranged. At the end, he obviously had multiple personalities, almost chopped his ex-wife's head off, and a stranger at the same time. Obviously, he was a big star. That was the big thing. He was likable to people that knew him, but nobody really knew him. Alan Dershowitz had his defense. He was part of the Dream Team. This is what he said last night, Cut 36.
Stephen A. is absolutely right. The LAPD was on trial. The predominantly black community and the jurors didn't trust the LAPD. And that's why it was so dangerous for Van Atter to try to enhance the evidence by creating that bloody sock, because it played right into the prejudices, perhaps, of the jurors against the LAPD.
Yeah, and I just want to get Cato Kaelin in. Was the bloody sock, is that agreed upon, that the bloody sock was concocted by the cops? Do you think that was, did you follow that, Eric, by any chance? Did you follow the trial? No?
I don't remember the bloody sock. Yeah.
I remember the glove. Okay. Here's Cato Kaelin last night. Cut 32.
I think he's guilty. I have that opinion, and I still believe that today. And I was listening to this show, and you sort of encapsulated the last 30 years, and I was going, oh, my, your monologue is just, it brought back so much to my feelings. I was, it was wonderful, you know, not wonderful, but it was like I went back in time, and I was thinking about that line you said about heaven and hell and believing it. Well, on his deathbed, I don't know if he said a penance or not, but I really believe he is guilty, and if he made peace with God or not.
I doubt it. I was watching somebody this morning that evidently was his former manager, but then spent years with him taping everything Adrian was doing. And this guy just wanted to party. He was going hanging out. So I think he had lost his mind. I think you have to compartmentalize, considering what your life was. It's bad enough. If you're a murderer, you never had probably a great life, but then he gets worse in jail. Got it. But what if you were hanging out with the elite Hollywood legends, athlete and star and broadcaster and a really handsome guy doing movies, and then all of a sudden you have everything and it all falls apart, and you look at the life you had and the people that were friends with you that no longer know your name? Bob Costa said he went to visit him in prison and basically just said, you know, get a good attorney, find out what happened. Al Michaels used to be friends with him. He taught Jim Gray used to be friends with him. But, you know, when something like that happens, it ends the next day. But he lived another, 25 years afterwards? Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, but we're heard around the country, around the world. So glad you're here. Thanks for being with us all week long. What a consequential time to be lucky enough to have a show like this. In this hour, we're going to be joined by Josh Krashauer, bring us inside the political process on Capitol Hill. Man, is this it for Speaker Johnson? And is Marjorie Taylor Greene to blame? Evidently, President Trump not happy about it. And Garrett Ventry is going to be with us, too. Garrett's a great guest. He's a founder and president of GRV Strategies, former senior advisor to Chuck Grassley. He's worked for Elise Stefanik right now as well. And we'll get to him, and we'll get to Josh in a moment. But let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And then the Mueller report came out, and no collusion. And, you know, I think we sort of went to sort of the story kind of disappeared. You know, despite our feelings about Trump, this is a story we should have sort of treated differently.
Yuri Berliner, NPR 25-year editor, coming out and talking about the anti-Trump bias. Yeah, he didn't vote for Trump and won't vote for Trump, but he blew up the whole newsroom and did the things we've been talking about. Now that newsroom has blowback on Yuri Berliner. We'll discuss it.
Number two.
Our most immediate concern has been that individuals or small groups will draw some kind of twisted inspiration from the events in the Middle East to carry out attacks here at home.
That is Christopher Wray. Get it together, guys. Terror challenges everywhere. Thanks to the terror den we repopulated, and as we left Afghanistan, and also the distrust growing between Americans, Congress, and the FBI. Meanwhile, a regional war looms as Iran prepares to directly hit Israel. Why I believe that won't happen.
Number one.
Can somebody explain to me in crayon eating terms why I make over three times the federal minimum wage and I cannot afford to live? And I do not want to hear the pull yourself up from your bootstraps, work 90 hours a week.
We talked to Nick Sumners. He works in the car industry, that's all he tells us, but he was on TikTok frustrated that he cannot pay his bills. His ultimate undoing, Joe Biden, inflation. 60% of the people like Nick, living paycheck to paycheck. Joe Biden's economy has been costly for all of us and ultimately could lead to his undoing. And blaming Trump will not work, especially when you said, I took over a country where inflation was skyrocketing. Come on, that's just not true. Just like it's not true you're the first Biden to go to college because you would tell us about your grandfather who was a college football player. Does that ever add up? Josh Krasauer joins us now, Fox News radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. Josh, welcome back. Out of all the attacks on Trump, that's not going to work, inflation.
No. I mean, this is the issue that's haunting Biden's reelection campaign. You look at every survey, and even as much as Biden officials are trumpeting good economic news, it's the inflation that is really driving many Americans who are looking at the rising costs of grocery and gas and a lot of other fundamentals. You know, you can't spin that away. And, you know, I thought it was very interesting that this week Biden, sort of realizing that interest rates are not going to go down because of rising inflation, hinted that they still might, or he was still trying to put some pressure on the Fed in that meeting with the Japanese prime minister to do so, or the Rose Garden session with the Japanese prime minister. That is wishful thinking, and it's a sign that we're kind of we're now at a point where people's perception of the economy is basically what you're going to see in November and how they vote. And it's not a good look. It's not a good perception for the president.
Yeah, because the interest rate's going up, and by forgiving more student loans, it's only going to give the perception that we're willing to have $1 trillion added to our debt every month. That's what's happening with interest rates higher, and they could get higher again. You know, Larry Summers says we're going to see an interest rate increase. So just give people an idea at home. This is the stats. This is what's put out by the grocery industry. In 2021, bread was 29% less expensive. Flour was 24% less expensive. Spaghetti is now 8% more expensive. Butter, 23%. So milk, 12%. Overall, 26% increase in your groceries. So if 60% of the people listening to us right now live paycheck to paycheck, I think this is really going to hit home more than any other 30-second ad. Don't you agree, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's what the most impactful political developments are ones that affect an individual's bottom line. You know, a lot of the debates we talk about in politics, people may feel passionately about issues, but they're abstract. That doesn't affect them day to day. But when you go to the grocery store and you're paying 20% more for eggs than you did 4 years ago, you're paying, you know, you laid out the stats, Brian. You feel that on a daily basis, and it really affects your anger at sort of the government and the president. So that is just a driving force in the president's low approval numbers. We've seen that ever since inflation jacked up in the first year or two of his presidency. And I think they were hoping that inflation was contained. They hoped they'd be going into this 2024 election year talking about how, you know, the economy's in good shape and inflation is under control. But we're seeing with the latest data, it's not under control. And if anything, it's heading in the wrong direction at the worst possible time.
It seems it. I want you to hear what Kevin Hearn said over in Oklahoma, cut eight.
I think also when you look at what's going on here, and we're at $35 trillion in debt, $34.6 trillion as of this morning and growing, too many people up here believe that debts, deficits don't matter. Overspending doesn't matter. The bloating of government doesn't matter. And I think it's important as a Republican conference that we got to continue to bring hope to the American people. That's why it's so important that we take the Senate, keep the House, and get the White House.
They're not going to do it if they blow up the speaker with Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's still thinking about doing it and seems to love talking to CNN about it, which is insane. But with the president, before I have you comment on that opportunity, is the speaker goes out to talk to President Trump at 4:30 today. He's going to have a press conference. Joe, I woke up today to find out that Joe Biden is forgiving another $7.48 billion in student loan debt. So now we have a situation where billions is forgiven to certain people. And one of the people that don't go to college, the ones that choose a vocational school or that paid off their loans, doesn't the president realize that those people are going to be as ticked off as the others are going to be happy?
Well, look, I think this is just naked purchasing a constituency. I mean, this is what you're seeing right now in our politics, and we've talked a lot about this, Brian, is that his big weak spot, Biden, is right now is with young voters. college educated people or 18 to 24 year olds who have gone to college, maybe have these debts. And they're not in love with Biden for a whole lot of reasons. A lot of them ideological, but also just the same economic challenges that everyone is facing. And he's seen that he's performing worse among young voters than any Democrat I can remember in a long time. And this is just a naked political way to try to buy their votes, to try to do what he can within. And I don't know if this is constitutional, because the Supreme Court has already weighed in on other similar measures that tried to relieve a larger degree of student debt. But, you know, he's trying to basically buy off some of these younger voters that may go third party, or even some of them looking to vote for Trump in the next election. So I think that's all this is. It's naked politics. And I'm also skeptical, Brian, that it works. I mean, it just drives the polarization even further, where, yes, maybe you'll make some inroads with Gen Z voters that have these student debts, but there are a whole lot of other voters that don't have a college. The majority of Americans don't have a college degree. They're dealing with the inflation we're talking about. They have debts in other spaces, medical debts, other economic challenges, and they're looking at the government essentially buying off a certain constituency, causing inflation potentially, and hurting other groups that are also much more significant than those young voters that are facing student debt.
So let's talk about the messaging on abortion. The president comes out earlier in the week, upset Lindsey Graham, but said, look, I want the states to decide. I'm pro-life, but let's let the states decide. A lot of people thought that was a good move. One day later, Arizona says, yeah, when we were a territory, we had it right. 0 weeks abortion. They tried to wheel it back. It didn't work. And now that they're messaging that against Trump, saying you're responsible. Now, Trump saying, yeah, I am responsible. But then they say, no, you're responsible for the overturn of Roe v. Wade. So how's that being? I know this is a very tough question because we've never been down a road like this. But how does this play out to you?
Well, look, I think it was actually a blunder for the Trump campaign to basically punt this all to the states and not actually state a position on at least.
So you're with Lindsey Graham on this. Pick 15
weeks.
Yeah,
look, Lindsey Graham favors a federal 15-week abortion ban with exceptions, which, if you look at polls, that has some degree of public support, though I wonder how that would play out if it actually came to the floor in the Congress. But the problem with punting it to the states is that you're going to see states like Arizona with the state Supreme Court, or you're going to see states that are much more conservative than Arizona take positions on abortion that are going to be hard to defend politically, and they're still going to fall on Trump's lap politically. And I think it's better for any candidate to kind of outline where they stand on an issue, even in the broadest of senses, and say, oh yeah, let the states decide, because ultimately they're going to be states that are making. We saw in Alabama with IVF earlier this year. We were seeing this with Arizona. They're going to be states that are going to take positions that are going to be politically toxic for Trump. And I think he's put himself in a pretty bad situation, where now he's trying to lobby Republicans in Arizona in the state legislature to overturn or at least pass legislation to mitigate the state court ruling. But it doesn't seem like they're very amenable to listening to him right now.
Lastly, I want you to go to the – I want to get your take on NPR. So Yuri Berliner, the NPR editor for the last 25 years, has had it. He saw the biasness is in his own newsroom, citing numerous times he'll never vote for Trump. But that wasn't the point. That's not his point. He says nobody's giving anyone a fair objective, whether it was the Hunter Biden laptop or whether it was the pandemic. Anthony Fauci is always right. Now they're encouraging different reporters to get involved in advocacies if it makes the world better. So you could go to a fundraiser. You could go to a rally if it makes the world better. Here's Yuri Berliner, the NPR editor, and it's causing shockwaves throughout Washington. Cut 27.
After a while, we started covering Trump in a way that, like a lot of the legacy news organizations, that we were trying to damage his presidency, to even find anything we could to harm him. And I think what we latched on to was Russia collusion, like a lot of news organizations, which was, as I write, sort of catnip, although it was just rumors and a lot of it based on pretty shoddy documents or evidence. It wasn't really solid, but I think it was compelling.
So that was compelling. And then when Adam Schiff was on over 25 times talking about everything and nothing panned out, there was no walk back. There was no justification. There was no investigation of the story and how they got it wrong. What do you think about it? Is he speaking for a lot of newsrooms?
Well, look, one of the most compelling parts of his testimony is that the audience of NPR a decade or two ago was tilted left. You know, it was a little more liberal than certainly conservative, but it was still well in the American mainstream. And then the latest data of NPR's audience has skewed heavily, heavily left and very white progressive left audience. And they've basically kind of become captive to that. It's kind of like their audience is now the squad, and they've been programming their news programs to appeal to that narrow slice of America. It's a far left slice of the country. It doesn't appeal to a whole lot of people. They've laid off a lot of workers. They've lost audience share over that same period of time. But it's in a direct result to what Uri was writing about, that they have sort of catered to a fringe of the audience at the expense of the mainstream. And NPR was, I mean, you know, everyone thought NPR, at least called cultural issues, always tilted a little bit to the left. But it was actually one of those channels that actually did have a pretty bipartisan audience a couple decades ago. That's no longer the case, and you can see it with the programs and the news choices they make.
And he said, look, we're trying to recruit all about diversity. He said, fine, you want to do diversity, do fine. He goes, did anyone think about diversity of thought instead of ethnicity and sexuality and sexual preference? Did anyone say to themselves, what about somebody that doesn't agree with me? And that's what astounded him. And now they have a new CEO, Catherine Mayer, who's been a leader in tech. She says she does not have a news background. She says that could be an asset. He goes, I'm rooting for her. It's a tough job. Her first rule could be simple enough. Don't tell people how to think. It could even be the new North Star. So they've taken a bunch of people out to lunch. Do you think this guy gets fired?
Well, one of the most remarkable things about the piece, Brian, is that he's a 25-year employee, a well-respected employee at National Public Radio, a business editor. And he is really he's a whistleblower. This is what you call someone who is really risking his job. As far as I know, he's still working at National Public Radio, but he was willing after all that time with the organization to be candid about some of the flaws and challenges that it faces. So it's a really, that's usually what we say. It's like if any whistleblower comes forward to that regard in the media, that they're usually praised and glorified for speaking hard truths. And unfortunately, when it comes to the media, when it comes to, when it's a media institution like NPR, I don't think they're looking at him quite so favorably.
Josh, fascinating time. Then we have the court case that starts on Monday with the former president of the United States going to be here Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Wednesday's off for 6 to 8 weeks. Incredible. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thanks, Brian.
And right now he's leading the polls. Well, how do you feel? Will this make him look better or worse? If the verdict, if it's a conviction, is it hurt him or does it make it look like he is further oppressed and that Joe Biden's behind it? After all, Matt Colangelo was in the Joe Biden Justice Department before he needed to leave to help resurrect this case. He's now leading it. There's really no connection to Joe Biden? Back with your calls.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We're certainly monitoring the situation closely. I don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not going to get into specific intelligence. I would just say that what you heard the president say, and as I highlighted in my topper, we are in close contact with the Israelis, to include today's phone call with Minister Gaunt, and that U.S. commitment to Israel's security against threats from Iran and its proxies is ironclad.
Right. Good. At least something would be stating positive for Israel. They're not the bad guys. And our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was in Israel on Thursday. Something's going on. Whether they called it off or not, I'm not sure. David, you're in Oklahoma. Hey, David.
Yes. Hello.
What's on your mind?
I was listening to your radio show this morning Oklahoma, and you're welcome. And I heard about, the guy from TikTok complaining about his wages. And I just wanted to say that, inflation is just insane right now. I worked in the oil field for almost 20 years as a derrick hand, 11 years as a derrick hand, my final 11 years. And I was making over close to $160,000 a year.
Wow.
In 2017, I got hurt on a job. I tore my labrum. I tore my rotator cuff.
Right.
I ended up having a total of 7 surgeries. My bicep was detached. I had 7 surgeries in my shoulders. Then, you know, through the course of that, you know, and not working, they found severe osteoarthritis.
Running out of time, David. What's your point?
Inflation is not going down anywhere. You know, I was on disability. I have paperwork. I'm legal disability. I had to go back to work because the bills ain't getting covered at home. Wow. Being on nearly $3,000 a month on
disability. And you were, when Trump was president, you were making ends meet?
Yeah, we were making ends meet. You know, we weren't getting ahead by per se, but we were not sinking.
Right, and that's exactly what the indications are. It's up 10%, 5%, 7%, 8%. But then when you put all the groceries in a cart, all of a sudden it is almost double. Back in a moment.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
But it was so racially charged because of what had happened just before with Rodney King, but also just how Black Americans feel about policing. It's not like O.J. Simpson was the leader of the civil rights movement of his era. You know, he wasn't a social justice leader, but he represented something for the Black community in that moment, in that trial. Particularly because there were two white people who had been killed, and the history around how Black people have been persecuted during slavery. There were just so many layers.
Wow, that was an interesting take over the sudden death of O.J. Simpson. Ashley Allison on CNN. That was the rationality, how everyone felt about race in the 90s. And maybe things are worse today. Let's get the perspective on what it means for the election with Garrett Ventry, founder and president of GRV Strategies and former senior advisor to Chuck Grassley, now doing work with a lot of potentially vice presidential candidates. Garrett, welcome back. What's your take on her take?
I mean, it's really an interesting take, I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I've not thought of it that way, obviously. You know, I think the OJ saga was very interesting watching. You know, I was younger when this happened, obviously, but, you know, going back and like, you see the white Bronco and all that stuff, it's very fascinating. But, you know, I think it is an interesting angle if you're probably an African American thinking about, you know, what was happening at that time, but that's not an angle I've ever really explored.
Right. One thing I was struck by what happened this week was President Trump going into the Chick-fil-A, all black workers.
Yep.
And I don't know if he knew what he was going to get.
Sure.
You tell me. I think it seems unscripted besides the security sweep. And he basically had a bunch of people that wanted to see him. And then one woman in particular turns out to be a teacher with the historically Black colleges. And so I don't care what anyone says, they tell me. And gave her a big, why don't you come over here and give me a hug?
Right.
From a political standpoint, what does that mean to you?
I mean, the really interesting thing here is Donald Trump is doing very well with the African-American vote. You're talking about, I mean, he's polling at some polls and Fox polling and New York Times polling at over 20%. So there's clearly a shift there.
Was it 12, right, last time?
Yeah, it's at 12, and it's been up to 20 at some point. But for a Republican to get double digits in the African-American vote, if that does happen, I mean, Joe Biden essentially, I don't know where he gets those votes from then, right? So it's definitely impressive here, and I think you're seeing there's a couple reasons why I think African-American voters are deeply dissatisfied with the economy. I also think there's a crime aspect here. A lot of the weak on crime stuff we've seen in New York City, cashless bail, those type of things. And then I do think some of the unprecedented indictments of Donald Trump do help him with the African-American community. And he said so as much. I think they feel and they see this as political, and a lot of them have felt that in their own lives, some of them.
Maybe. But like when it's all said and done, to get Mitt Romney at 8.
Yeah.
So the former president got into double figures last time. And if he's over 20 this time, but if you're working for Trump and he says to you, Garrett, I need to pull over. Let's just go, you know I'm hungry.
Yeah.
So why don't you just come over? Why don't we order some fast food? You know, we've done it before. And the way, would you have said to him, Mr. President, this could go wrong? You know, you're going into a heavily urban environment where some of these people have been told horrible things about you.
Right.
So he went in anyway, and it worked out.
I think it's the brilliance of it, too, that he's done these things, whether it's these retail stops have been really successful for him. And you've seen this at, you know, UFC has been very successful. You
Huge.
See him watching.
Well, he knows what he's getting there.
He knows what he's getting there. I saw him, you know, I was there in Vegas when the president was there for a fight a couple months back and, you know, just erupts. So you see that, and you've seen this over and over again with these retail stops that he's having, traditionally like areas that wouldn't go for a Republican. So it does show there's a lot of quiet support for Donald Trump, and a lot of people are just dissatisfied with Biden. But it's a brilliant political move by President Trump, and there is this appeal he has when people do meet him. He is larger than life, and it kind of takes away some of the things that the media have maybe said about him when people meet him and they find out he's a, you know, regular, energetic guy.
What does it tell you that CNN is now at the border with a drone and a reporter? Yeah. And then what does it mean to you that Mayorkas says, oh, yeah, we are in a crisis?
Yes.
And what does it mean to you that the majority of Hispanic Americans now want a wall?
It's absolutely
remarkable.
Think
about how far, the mind-blowing from 2015.
Absolutely remarkable, right? And I think what you're seeing here is that this is, they all realize this is a major issue. Immigration is the number one issue to voters right now. It's not abortion. It's not the economy, although the economy is up there.
Inflation's big.
And inflation is big. But the immigration and Gallup polling and other polls I've seen, it's, you know, that's kind of the big issue here. And so it's interesting to see these people like Mayorkas, who literally created this crisis by, you know, ending Title 42, stopping construction on the border wall, which you mentioned now is popular with Hispanic voters, you know, getting back in catch and release. And you've seen 9 million people come here illegally under Joe Biden that we know of. And so it's clearly a crisis when CNN is, you know, down there with a drone. But you know, they have really they mocked Republicans for years when we talked about we need border
security.
They
mock Fox.
Correct. They mock you guys for saying that. And it turns out you do. You have people like known terrorists trying to come here and have been here in our country, so, crossing the border illegally.
And Gary, too, from we're in New York and
right.
You may feel it. Do you live here?
Yeah.
So when you find out that they're in Yonkers fighting with cops in the lobby right. And then the woman followed the guy who was arrested. And then she gets arrested, too. They get let go. So they get the Ramada in for free. They get three meals for free.
Right.
They get in here for free. They beat the whole system.
Correct.
And they brawl in the lobby. When the cops show up, they fight Correct. The cops and the Venezuelans that beat up the two cops.
Right.
And then in the CVS uptown on the east side, there's a robbery going on. The cops show up and they fight the cops.
Right.
And they get arrested. And four of the five get let out the same day. So what does that do? When people talk about crime and illegal immigrants coming here, they're not sending us their best.
Right.
This underlines it's hard to game plan against that.
No, absolutely. And I think the thing here is if you take a step back, people who come here illegally and love America and want to be part of our system, that's what America's been made of for many years. Coming here illegally, being part of it, understanding the Constitution,
yeah.
Understanding the values that we have. And that's been great for our society. What you have here is you have people with complete disregard for our laws. And you have people with disregard for law enforcement. And when you're putting – you know, crime's always going to happen. You're never going to be able to get rid of crime completely. But a lot of this is intentional when you're talking about cashless ballot, just letting these people back on the street when they're dangerous. And it's ridiculous that the Democrats like can't condemn it. It's wild to me.
You know, I say it over and over again because I don't want people to forget it. There's a 76-year-old CFO of the Trump Organization at Rikers Island.
Right.
But we can't get a Venezuelan
Correct.
Fighting a cop.
Right.
He gets out with
Correct.
Zero cash bail.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
This is the second stint, by the way, for the 76-year-old
yep.
who backed up that Donald Trump had overinflated the size of his penthouse. If we don't get those people off the street, we're never going to be safe. Those 76-year-old accountants, they're the worst. It's horrible. imagine them in the subways. Unsupervised. It'd be incredible. So I want to talk about what's happening in the House.
Yeah.
Embarrassing again for Speaker Johnson. He puts on the floor a renewal of the FISA Act with amendments and with changes from 2018. He gets 19 Republicans who vote against it. They want to do Ukraine aid. He thinks we need it. I think we need it. But he's not going to get any trade-off of border. So
sure.
Marjorie Taylor Greene says, if you do this, I'm going to make a run at you. I'm going to call for your ouster. He's going to go meet with the president today at 4:30. Bring us inside the Republican majority.
Yeah, I mean, it's flimsy right now, right? You're talking about, you know, in 2022, we thought there was going to be this massive red wave. We're going to have 25, 30-seat majority. That obviously didn't happen. Then you've had things like George Santos getting expelled, Ken Buck and Mike Gallagher leaving Congress early, and the majority is very slim right now. And it's a tough job. The doing the speaker's tough job to begin with, right? You've got to corral, you know, over 218 members to, like, agree on something, right? That's tough to do. You can barely get five people to agree. Like, if we went around here, where do you want to go to lunch? You're going to get five different answers. So imagine that with 218 members. So that's tough there. And then the other thing is you have this influence of Donald Trump over the party here. And
right.
You're seeing this with Speaker Johnson going down to Mar-a-Lago, obviously, to talk about an issue that President Trump cares about in election integrity. And the other part is Trump is dictating a lot of this policy, too. He's anti-Ukraine funding, and he came out against FISA in its in its original state. And so those things drive these members and give them cover. And the more the slimmer the majority you have, the more power individual members have, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz, where if you had a 20 or 30 person majority, you know, a lot of times it's just noise. But right now they actually have power because they can do things with a small majority.
But having said that, Nancy Pelosi negotiated with a similar.
Sure.
And they seem to be on the same page, even the crazy squad.
Sure.
So she found a way to do that. And having said that, now you have an inexperienced speaker, great intellect, great mind, wonderful disposition, but he does not know how to corral the troops. He does not know. He does not know how to work the corner. And you had a guy that knew how to do that in Kevin McCarthy. Would the Republicans actually go down that road again? Would Marjorie Taylor Greene, is she bluffing?
I don't know. It's a great question. She obviously has demands, and she feels like she's representing her constituents on those demands. So, you know, one understands that. I don't think there's much of an appetite, though, for House Republicans to have another nasty speakership battle. And I think you're not seeing a ton of people go that route right now, even though there might be disagreement with the speaker on a number of issues right now. He's also in an impossible situation. You're talking about you have to do things like, you know, you've got to do things on FISA. You've got to do things on funding the government. And so he's in an impossible job here. And so it's going to be tough with a slim majority here, whoever is in that job. The question is, if you get rid of Johnson, right, you get rid of him, who's next? Who can do the job like that?
And nobody.
The question is, like, there really isn't. He was the guy who could get to 218 that the conference was like, we like him. They didn't want Jordan. They didn't want Emmer. They didn't want Scalise. Johnson was the acceptable option for everybody. They all voted for him.
So here's what Kimberly Strassel, the Wall Street Journal, said. Cut 31.
The Trump team, and I think it's been a little slow to get to this understanding, is beginning to realize that having a House caucus, the only branch of government Republicans run at the moment, look like it's in perpetual and continual disarray, unable to lead or get anything done, is not exactly a great advertisement when you are headed into a presidential election arguing that you should be giving the White House as well and the Senate. And so there's this key things coming up. This is, I think, a message from Trump, potentially, at least quietly, to some of these critics of Johnson to give him some breathing room. We'll see.
So that's what I'm wondering. If that meeting today at 4:30 supposed to be about election integrity,
right,
if they're going to have a bigger conversation, and maybe Johnson says, listen, you got to give me a heads up if you're going to blow up FISA the day before. And today they're supposed to vote on it at 8:30,
right,
a 2-year deal.
Right.
And there have been reforms to it, too.
Yeah. And it just passed a rule. So we'll see if it actually, you know.
So it could be voted on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they'll end up getting there. The speaker has a good relationship with President Trump. President Trump seems to like the speaker a lot. He, you know, one of the things he didn't like about Kevin McCarthy is he dragged his feet and didn't endorse him. And Speaker Johnson came out and endorsed him. And the president appreciates loyalty, obviously, as you know. And so I think he likes that about him. And I think Speaker Johnson is a conservative deep down. He's dealing with issues, though, with a slim majority, right? I do think this serves the greater purpose. It shows the power of Trump, right? You're talking about the one guy who can give you cover on these types of issues is Donald Trump. You've seen that abortion, and you're seeing it now here with Speaker Johnson.
Garrett Ventry here. And Gary, you know what it is, and I think this is a brilliant analogy. You ready for it? If you're a great player, it doesn't mean you're a great coach.
Right.
So he's a very good delegate, does a good job. He's very smart, intellectual, understands the Constitution. But it doesn't mean you're going to be a great coach. And as a speaker, no one cares how smart you are. How street smart can you be,
right,
to be able to find out what the hot buttons are for these people? Like one thing Kevin McCarthy said to me on One Nation last week is, you got to talk to Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's a smart person.
Right.
She wants to be dealt with. You just got to deal with her,
right,
because she's into it. You know, she's aggressive. So if you put something out there without talking to her first, she's going to end up blowing up. You have to understand what the volatile players are like. Maybe,
right,
you got to give him some more attention. But remember, she was for McCarthy. She was not for his ouster.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a couple things here. Most members, you saw this with Jim Jordan in 2018, too. McCarthy made that alliance with him, which was very smart. Remember, him and Jordan used to be like
butting
heads, and they were strong allies. And you saw the same thing with MTG. I do think, he was smart for him to meet with her recently, which he did. And a lot of these members, they want a seat at the table, and they want their voice to be heard. And they're used to, like, leadership trying to ram things down their throat that they don't like, generally speaking. So I do think Speaker Johnson's done a better job with that lately here, reaching out to Marjorie Taylor Greene, reaching out to some of these other members here. And again, you're talking about doing the job with a 1 or 2 seat majority right now, basically. It's a very tough job to do. I do think what a lot of members do like about Speaker Johnson is they see him as an honest broker. They do. They don't think he's lying to them. And you know, I think they think he's doing the best job with a very slim majority right now. And they do like that, you know, a lot of these more MAGA members do appreciate that he is pro-Trump.
And when we come back, the chances that they hold on to the House, you know, because people say that ship has sailed, but is it really? And believe it or not, when it comes to retirements, more Dems have retired
right.
than Republicans. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. A few more minutes with Garrett Ventry when we return. Don't move.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back. A few more minutes with Garrett Ventry. And the big question is, with this camp chaos that the Republicans have put together, ousting their speaker, the slow walking of the impeachment of Joe Biden, the inquiry, I like what it's resulted, but I don't understand the dormant stages, the Mayorkas situation, and the lack of accomplishment. Could the Republicans actually still retain the House? Garrett, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible. Or again, like this is all going to come down to California and New York, right? That's where a lot of these Biden districts are. You know, those members, I think that there's two things here. Those members have to be able to kind of run their own race here. But I do think Trump does help.
You mean
on the
without
ballot.
The top of the ticket?
Correct. But I do think Trump is a net positive, even in 2020, right? When you had, you know, we didn't do as well in the Senate, but we picked up 15 seats in the House in 2020, even though, you know, the president wasn't able to get over the finish line in 2020. We picked up 15 seats. He's a net positive generally for Republicans when he's on the ballot. And so I think that is helpful to them. I do think it's going to come down to they have good issues on border, on crime, on the economy. They need to stick to those. And House Republicans have passed some things that obviously Senate Democrats don't want to take up, like H.R. 2, a very strong border provision that would secure the border. They've went after, you know, some of the IRS, 87,000 IRS agents that's deeply unpopular. They passed that. A lot of it's just Schumer doesn't want to take up some of the things they actually have been able to accomplish. So that's part of it here. And so I think for them, they're going to have to, you know, Trump's a net positive. You got to be able to run a race that actually works in your district. And the biggest part of this is, like, do you do your constituent service as well?
Right. Right?
People who serve their constituents well usually do survive. Those that don't have a tougher time.
Well, we'll see. I guess we'll see what's going to happen there. Trump still thinks he's got designs on New York, and he says I might have a Madison Square Garden event.
Be pretty awesome.
Would you encourage him to go into urban environments?
Yeah.
Do you think, and even though we could John McCain style combat, you know, McCain used to go into
right.
these areas and
right.
used to hear people tell what a bad, how bad sure. Republicans were and that they lied about the war. And
sure.
he liked that.
Sure.
I mean, do you think engaging Trump in a debate, do you think that makes could make the president look vulnerable, the former president?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that, again, I think one of his biggest strengths is, like, when people meet him, they generally like him. They do. Like, even if they have this, you know, I should say the regular, you know, average person. They have these preconceived notions of what they've heard in media, and then they meet him and they find out he's a really energetic, interesting character, right? And so I do think for him, you are seeing popularity among the black vote. And I think doing, you know, rallies, whether it's in New York City, in Philadelphia, in Chicago, in the inner cities, I think that is helpful because these people, this group of voters, the African-American vote, is very gettable for Republicans. We're not going to win it, but you could see a scenario where it gets 15 or 20% of the vote.
Wow. And Lee Stefanik is somebody you're working with?
Yes.
So do you believe that she is on the president's shortlist for a running mate?
That is what the public I know about as much as the public does on that. It's the public's, you know, I've seen reporting in the media where that seems to be the case here. And I think she's commented publicly and saying that obviously would be an honor for her. I'm obviously very biased and think she would be very good for a number of reasons.
What are her qualities that stand out?
I think there's a couple. One, number one is I think she, for President Trump, she's someone who's very loyal and has been a chief defender of the president. I think that's point one. I think number two, she can raise a lot of money. She just raised $7 million as a House member this quarter. That's a big deal. I think three is she understands how Capitol Hill is and how to navigate that when President Trump's trying to do his agenda. And number four, I think she's been able to go into mainstream media like NBC and CNN to defend the president's agenda in a strong way that not many people can do.
All right, Garrett Ventry, that's a strong case.
I thought about it once or twice.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. Brian Kilmeade Show. This hour is going to be great. Finishing out strong, the great Shannon Bream back from vacation. Congressman Dan Crenshaw, Texas. A lot going on in the House today. We could have a vote on extending FISA with some reforms, 702. And then the Speaker of the House at 4:30 having a joint press conference with President Trump in Mar-a-Lago. So impactful. I think Trump realizes having the House in chaos, not good for him, not for good for his party. He's trying to get everybody on the same page. If he does win and loses the House, his life is a lot more difficult. Plus, he likes Johnson. So my suggestion is, Mr. President, if you are listening, talk to Marjorie Taylor Greene. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And then the Mueller report came out, and no collusion. And, you know, I think we sort of went to sort of the story kind of disappeared. You know, despite our feelings about Trump, this is a story we should have sort of treated differently.
You think so? I'm fascinated by this story. Out of all the stories this week, this has just got me. Yuri Berliner, he's a 25-year veteran NPR editor, and he just talks about how severe bias at his organization and backlash since he came forward and wrote about it and went on Barry Weiss's podcast. What does it mean for NPR? And how many other newsrooms are exactly like he described, Trump haters?
Number two.
Our most immediate concern has been that individuals or small groups will draw some kind of twisted inspiration from the events in the Middle East to carry out attacks here at home.
Well, that would bother me too, didn't you? Get it together, guys. Terror challenges everywhere. Thanks to the Terror Den, we repopulated with when we left Afghanistan. As the distrust grows between Americans, Congress, and the FBI. Meanwhile, a regional war looms versus Iran as they prepare to hit Israel. They say, would they have the guts to do it? Because they'll get hit back.
Number one.
Can somebody explain to me in crayon eating terms why I make over three times the federal minimum wage and I cannot afford to live? And I do not want to hear the pull yourself up from your bootstraps, work 90 hours a week.
Guy cracks me up. Nick Summers, 20 years old, didn't go to college and working double minimum wage and can't make ends meet. His ultimate undoing, it'll be inflation and people like Nick. I'm talking about President Biden. 60% of this country living paycheck to paycheck and prices rising steady since he got the job. This economy could cost him. And blaming Trump, well, that dog won't hunt because the numbers don't lie. When Trump left, inflation was 1.4%. With me right now to discuss this, a woman who doesn't do her own shopping. That's why she has a domestic staff. But she does understand when the butlers come home and the maids report to her that prices are going up in the supermarket. Is that correct, Shannon Bream of Fox News Sunday?
Oh, if that were true. I do like to use me some Instacart now and then. So somebody is technically running out to get me some things sometimes.
Right.
I'm very appreciative and I'm a good tipper.
So I was just seeing some of this. These are hard numbers. I mean, here we are 3 years in. Bread is 29% more expensive. Eggs is 104% more expensive. Milk, 12% more expensive. Overall, groceries are up 26%. So this means a lot. President Biden said, well, it was skyrocketing when I took over. Shannon Bream, we got a PolitiFact even says that's not close to true.
Right. And they've been calling him out on a number of things when it comes to claims he makes about the economy and the deficit and job creation, all that kind of thing. So this isn't just, you know, conservatives questioning what he's saying. These are these supposedly neutral and I would argue in some cases left-leaning outlets that are saying it's not true. You've got Ron Klain, the former White House chief of the staff, out there saying, you know, quit going out and talking about your bridges and infrastructure and stuff when people know their real-time reality check every day when they go to buy eggs and milk and fill up their gas tanks, they know the reality of what's actually going on. So, I mean, I felt like this week with Edward Lawrence when he was engaging with Karine Jean-Pierre at the White House, you're not getting a realistic look at what's going on. If they're going to tell us things are skyrocketing then, they want to blame Ukraine and Russia. There were a lot of these things that were already happening on President Biden's watch. So I feel like for a lot of voters who the polling shows they are not buying it on the economy, it would probably go a long way to say, like, you know what, there have been problems. And we acknowledge that this has happened on our watch. But here's how we're going to turn it around. Not say you're all crazy and this didn't actually happen.
So I looked at Edward Lawrence's exchange, but KJP said nothing. And I go, I'm not going to pull this because she doesn't even answer the question. The questions are great, but she might as well be talking about, you know, the chances of the Rangers winning the Stanley Cup. It has nothing to do with the question. But here's what Steve Scalise said, the congressman from Louisiana. Cut 7.
You watched the State of the Union. What did Joe Biden talk about? You know, when you shave off all the angry, divisive rhetoric, which was most of what he said, he talked about raising more taxes on hardworking families. Families are sick of the increased spending and increased taxes that are crushing their chance to get the American dream. And so House Republicans, with that one vote majority, are the only thing standing in the way of those higher taxes, that higher inflation that Joe Biden wants to impose upon those families.
And the winner of this election will decide if the Trump tax cuts continue.
Right.
And they have been bringing in a lot of revenue prior to the pandemic. I talked to Larry Kudlow and these guys. They were convinced this deficit was going down without the China virus.
Yeah, I mean, if things had continued to play out the way that they were, if they stayed on track, I mean, every indication was that was going to be true. So, like, you know, Karine Jean-Pierre, when she was engaging with Edward, kept saying, like, well, there was a pandemic. Well, yeah, that pandemic was happening under President Trump, too. And still during that time, inflation was held pretty steady for about 11 months at that point. So they can blame, you know, all kinds of things looking backwards. But what they need to do is make an argument about the present and looking forward, because people know what their everyday situation is. And how are you going to change that? You've had 3 years. And most people would say, in our polling, New York Times polling, all the polling out there, that things have only gotten worse for them. And also there's a pessimism about the future. The polling also shows that people think things are not getting better, that they're going to get worse before there's any chance for them to get better. And that's a tough pill to swallow for the current commander-in-chief in an election year.
Right. I want to talk about NPR if I can. Yuri Berliner, do you know him?
I don't.
Okay. It seems like somebody you would like. So he's an editor
I didn't know about.
But he just talked about the newsroom that he saw and the environment since Trump won the election. He doesn't recognize his organization. Cut 26.
I think, like every newsroom, every legacy media newsroom, we were shocked, disturbed, distraught, really troubled. We assumed Hillary Clinton was going to win, and she didn't. And it was really an unsettling experience. But I also think, to me, it revealed that we didn't really understand a lot of what was going on in America, that we were out of touch.
And it got worse. Cut 27.
After a while, we started covering Trump in a way that like a lot of legacy news organizations, that we were trying to damage his presidency, to find anything we could to harm him. And I think what we latched on to was Russia collusion.
And they talked about interviewing Adam Schiff 25 times and just taking him at his word. And when it collapsed, mm-hmm. they never adjusted it. This got so bad. So this week he publishes a column in the Free Press and goes on with Barry Weiss. And basically, Shannon, how I feel, it was like everything that we've been talking about, how astounded we were and how unfair and misconstrued some of President Trump's statements are, as unorthodox as he is. They were just taking everything that was going on and twisting it. And every time he'd get something going, there'd be some element of the Russian hoax that would pop up. And then when it turned out there was nothing there, nobody felt like it was necessary to adjust it because Trump was so awful. So my question is, how many newsrooms are reading this? And how many Yuri Berliners who don't vote for Trump are just outraged and saying, that's not why I got in this business?
Well, listen, I was stunned at the level of transparency for him, because if you've worked in different newsrooms, which I have over the years, I mean, I've been at Fox, it's been a blessing almost 17 years, but I have worked in other newsrooms, and you find out very quickly that a lot of folks are on the same page, and it's definitely left of center. So those are conversations that I've been around many times where people aren't trying to hide or soften or camouflage in any way how they really feel about a particular president or a leader or an election. And so I think we've all seen it if you've worked at different places. I was just surprised that he was so boldly open about it. But I do think we've seen over the last few years that a lot of newsrooms and places have gone public with this. They've stopped acting like journalists and they've gone to full-on advocacy. So they're not necessarily hiding it. But there are some organizations that put themselves out there as news organizations that are neutral. And I believe these are the kind of conversations that happen in those newsrooms. I've seen that myself. It's been a long time since I've been anywhere but Fox, but I've witnessed it. You probably have too.
$3 million they get from the federal government, but $90 million from local stations. If Trump wins, he's going to go for that. My hope is, I know a lot of people that listen to it. I love the international stories when I get to it. Never been part of my daily life like some people, but I do appreciate the reach. He did his own poll, 87 registered Democrats, no registered Republicans. So yesterday there was some blowback, and Edith Chapin, who's an NPR editor-in-chief, said this in an email to staff. We're proud to stand behind the exceptional work what our desks and shows to do to cover a wide range of challenging stories. We believe that inclusion among our staff and our sourcing and our overall coverage is critical to telling the nuanced stories of this country and our world. Now, they didn't say what he said wasn't true. What his point was, you wanted to hire for diversity. How about diversity of thought and not of skin color, ethnicity, and sexual preference? And that's coming from a guy that's never going to vote for Donald Trump. These are the types of things I hold on to, Shannon, because I want to get things back to normal. I want to go back to, okay, he did this good, he did this bad, as opposed to he does everything bad.
Well, and I would think that if you're a news organization, you would appreciate the differences of people from different places, different thoughts, different schools. You know, so you're going to get more of a read on people. Then you won't be so shocked when things happen like President Trump wins in 2016. You wouldn't be completely taken by surprise from that because you would have heard from people who are from different places and have different families and have different viewpoints on the world. When everything is monolithic in a newsroom ideologically, you are going to miss stories. You're going to miss trends. You are going to miss things that you'd be a better news organization if you had more diversity of thought in your newsroom.
So, Shannon, what do judging everything I just told you and how much we've gone out of the way to cover, how does that affect your Sunday show, Fox News Sunday?
Well, it is going to be a plethora of topics, of guests. Of course, what will happen first is Saturday night watching your show to
9 o'clock
for my show. Senator John Kennedy, who never leaves you wondering how he feels about something, is going to be with us. We also are going to have one of President Trump's attorneys as he goes in that first criminal trial, jury selection starting there Monday in New York City. He'll be with us to talk through that and also preview the Supreme Court immunity case. And I hate to tell you this, but the Democrat who was supposed to be on our show just flaked. So we are rebooking, as often happens, on Friday afternoon.
Was it President Biden?
No.
Oh.
No, but you know how it is with guests. Like, you don't ever want to announce them until they're 100,000% locked in. And so we just had a little hiccup, but you know, we are always fair and balanced. And so we will work around the clock till we get a Democrat to join us at the table.
You're nothing but not resilient. Do you want to ask me who I'm having on my show?
I would love to. I already know because I saw your promo, but please tell me again.
Glenn Greenwald's going to be on. Marco Rubio is going to be with us. Rick Prado is going to be here, CIA guy. Also going to have Kennedy and a special interview with a guy that looks great in a jean shirt. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Jimmy Fallon?
Mike Rowe.
Oh, even better.
Right. Allison, do you know, does Jimmy Fallon look good in a jean shirt?
Because
I see him in like cowboy shirts and...
I just want to know if you got a segment on the breakup of the marriage of the Golden Bachelor, who's only been married 3 months.
Wait a second. The Golden Bachelor was married?
They got married in January. It was a big national TV special, and they just announced they're getting divorced. I can't keep up with these people.
Who would think that something like as natural as a bachelor contest that results in a quick marriage would end up in divorce?
I feel like people in their 70s should know what they're doing. They said they want to get married quickly because, you know, time was ticking. But I guess now they want to get divorced quickly because time is ticking. They want to go look for option C.
I
know you're going to handle it with respect and depth.
Do you think should I cancel Rubio and just get on somebody dating in their 70s?
You should ask him about the Golden Bachelor.
All right, don't cancel.
Marriage and divorce. You
don't
keep
cancel.
Him booked, but change subject.
See, my news instinct was to get somebody more appropriate. Your news instinct is take the things you're interested in and ask him. Ask. It doesn't matter who it is.
No, because I feel like a good, smart guest is going to be able to handle any topic.
Right. Especially if is there a Hispanic? One of them Hispanic?
Not that I know of.
Oh, then forget it.
Not that I know of, but one of my favorite contestants on this Golden Bachelor was Hispanic. She was beautiful, and maybe he just picked the wrong person. I don't know.
Right. Can I work on this when I'm off the air, or do I have to finish this? Like,
text
do I have
me
to
if you need any talking points or help.
Thank you. Shannon Bree, welcome back.
See Saturday.
You got it. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Dan Crenshaw. Coming up next, you. I see you up there, 1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I want you to acknowledge that the open border policy makes us more insecure than strong. So I want to know, what have your discussions been with the president? Have you been able to go into his office and say, boss, this open border policy is a galactically stupid policy from a national security perspective? Have you had that conversation? If so, what did that look like? What has been the response? And how are we shaping this to make us more secure in the future?
Well, I'm not going to get into specific conversations with people. I've been consistent in my message externally and internally about my concerns about the threats that are from the FBI's perspective that emanate from the border.
So that's what drives people nuts. Just to say, I went to the president. I expressed to him how strong I believe we need to reinforce the border. That's what Republicans get upset about. Just why are you playing politics? But his pushback would be, it is politics. If I go in and said, I told the president, you better seal the border. For the longest time, the president was saying the border is sealed. And Mayorkas was saying it is not a crisis. So he feels as though he's inserted himself politically. Robert Mueller, I didn't see lighting people up. But the way you do it is saying, through the southern border, I'm most concerned about this, this, and this. Is the border closed? Not that I can tell. You're not playing politics by answering like that. Steve, WABC in Brooklyn, New York.
Hi. Yes. When I discuss with people of the left wing, and they say to me, why would these people, like the president, why do they want to have criminal elements come in across the Mexican border? Why do they want to release all the prisoners from Rikers Island? I say it's very simple. Politics and politicians attract a criminal element because of power, influence, money. And whether it's Biden or Andrew Cuomo or Tish James or Alexandria Cortez or our two recent catastrophes of mayors, de Blasio and now Eric Adams. Every one of them has criminal thinking in their head, and they realize they could be ending up in their own jails. So they better – there's the old saying that misery loves company. Well, criminality loves company.
I could be incompetence, too, and also I think it's something even more direct. I know that the getting illegal aliens to vote is not going to happen, but because they're going to have to be a pathway, and right now the Republicans wouldn't sign off on a pathway, but the census is putting people into different cities and different states, ups that congressional leadership and congressional seats, and then if you get that in a red or a blue, that helps you tilt a very tight house. So even if Democrats take the House, it's only going to be about 5 seats, 10 seats, and the Republicans, same thing. Because that's the new situation there with the gerrymandering. Unless you bring in 7 million people that don't belong here. 7 million. Because evidently they count in the census, even though Trump tried to stop that. Listen, when we come back, Dan Crenshaw, he's speaking on the House floor right now. He wants to renew FISA with changes. He's going to be joining us now to see if a vote is imminent. If he's a little late, I'm taking some of your calls. Thanks so much for being here. And a big announcement.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Iran doesn't want any escalation of this that would lead to a war with Israel or the United States. That has been the fact from the beginning of the war in Gaza when they operationalized all of their proxies to join in that effort that Hamas started. And this administration has never recognized that Iran's vulnerability is that they do not want war with the United States or Israel. If you want to shut down these proxies, take out the IRGC assets in Iran, because Iran does not want to escalate. You can use that as leverage against them. They have a weak Air Force. They have a weak Navy. Iran knows that war with them would destroy their regime economically, and also they would likely lose it.
So General Jack Keane puts it in perspective. He does the Institute for the Study of War. He looks at armaments. He looks at thresholds. He looks at quality of fighting forces. That's why he's so invaluable in Ukraine and now in Gaza. And he's outraged. Outraged that we're abandoning the IDF. Why? Because civilians are dying, and that's sad. But understand who's putting them in front. It is Hamas. Why the president doesn't mention that? And a lot of the stuff that we are hearing front and center at press conference with the Japanese prime minister. We used to get behind closed doors, but behind closed doors, President Biden is upset with the prime minister Netanyahu. He thinks he'd be more careful about civilian casualties, but now it's front and center. And what you have to understand, and I know you do, is that when you come out there and show a fracture between two allies, Hamas has no reason to do a deal. Do you know after a conversation, the whole IDF pulled out of the south? Now, they said it was to rest and refit. But because of that, Hamas immediately went back into the south and they fired some rockets out of the south. So why would Hamas feel as though they got to negotiate shoulder to shoulder and face to face with the IDF, with Qatar, in Qatar, if they're already getting what they want? No, I don't want any raid of Rafah. Well, if I'm Hamas, I feel great about that. I'll relax. I'm going to have a big lunch. Might even have an outdoor picnic. Here's more from Jack Keane, Cut 22.
All the covert successful operations that Israel has done, killing nuclear scientists, military leaders inside Iran, blowing up the centrifuges in one of their major nuclear enterprise sites at Natanz in 2020, Iran never responded to any of that. And that's right. The reality of this. They've always been very measured when they're dealing with Israel, and they're likely to be here. They don't have much choice. They're going to have to do something in terms of an attack. The timing of it, and any of us can speculate that when that's going to happen.
I don't know, because they told us it was going to happen as early as last night. They shut down the airspace over Iran. And Germany have stopped. Germany is the only Western country, I believe, flying into Tehran. They stopped it. So something was going on, and then maybe they backed off. Also, the U.S. had made it clear, we got your back. And other people say that we might have made it clear, you know, have at it if you need to. I'm not going to stop you, which would be insanity, while Ukraine runs out of weapons, too. So General Jack Keane says, listen, they got vulnerabilities. They know it. You know, something else I was reading over in the Jerusalem Post, they were having the militants were shooting at their Revolutionary Guard. They're trying to take over their bases. This has nothing to do with us. This is because it's such an unpopular, oppressive government. And this is a highly educated population. They want their quality of life back. And they can't get it since 1979. But what bothers me most, and this is what, and I'm going to have this theme on One Nation this weekend, is that the way we abandon allies. Afghanistan, whatever you think, I know there was some red on green shootings, and there was some people there pretended to be part of the army, and they end up killing our guys, and it's horrific. But for the most part, we gave a generation a chance at freedom to a degree, women a chance to populate. We trained an army of 100,000, some of which had no choice but to flip. The others didn't show the courage we needed. But we showed people the way for 20 years, and we show we wouldn't abandon them. Then we leave. Don't even tell NATO. Then when it comes to Israel, we're there in the beginning, but when times get tough, we hit the road. And Ukraine. I blame mostly Republicans and the lack of communication from this White House. They never talk about the mission. They never talk about completion. They never talk about the value. They never have even surrogates sit down and explain to the American people what's happening, go through a series of town halls, talk about what Mark Thiessen wrote about, and that's how our weapons are being replenished with modern things as we sell them or give them to Ukraine. So all those things together and abandoning of our allies tells our enemies we can be beat and it's their time to unify and that they're winning and that maybe we have an opportunity. So want to take a break? Oh, all right, good. So Congressman Crenshaw, we understand, just left the floor. So he's going to be joining us shortly on the other side. He's trying to get FISA passed. He's all for it. He wanted to see the reforms too. The Texas Congressman, Navy SEAL, when we come back.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Section 702 is indispensable in keeping Americans safe from a whole barrage of fast-moving foreign threats. It is crucial to identifying terrorists in the homeland, working with or inspired by a rogues gallery of foreign terrorist organizations who have publicly called for attacks against our country.
So that is some of my hairs on fire. Please notice that Christopher Wray was trying to present yesterday in front of Congress. Well, people look, and he says, don't cut $500 million from my budget at a time when I've ever been more challenged, and I need 702 renewed. What does that all mean? Congressman Dan Crenshaw joins us now. Just left the House floor trying to get this passed. He's the author of Fame, Blame, and the Raft of Shame. Congressman, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. I forgot about that book. thanks for mentioning it. It was Fortitude is my main one. But appreciate how you doing.
Good, good. So we just like to dig things up on your background. So, Congressman, what's going on the House floor? Could you guys get a vote on renewing 702, and should we?
Well, there will be a vote because the rule passed, and now we're in the middle of debate. I was late calling you because I had to speak on one of my amendments to the bill. My amendment would allow us to actually collect intelligence using FISA on the drug trafficking networks, trafficking fentanyl into the United States, including their Chinese counterparts. You might be shocked to hear this. We actually don't legally have the right right now to even get a warrant to collect on the facilitators and Chinese production facilities that are putting fentanyl into this country. And
what do you mean?
There's even Republicans who are against even that. I understand if you just kind of hate the FISA program, whatever, I get it. But you're against collecting on the cartels? This is where we're at. This is not a reasonable conversation being had. So I'm a little worried about it. I think my amendment will pass and then become law. And we need it to, because look, I'm not going to look any more parents in the eye when their kids died of a fentanyl overdose and tell them, we wanted to give those cartel members and Chinese communists a few more rights, right? Yeah, we didn't want to collect on them. And so your son's dead. No, not saying that to them.
So what is your concern about the 702 program? How has it been abused before?
Well, it's definitely been abused. So the most famous abuse, of course, is the Carter Page, Crossfire Hurricane thing. Now, 702 wasn't abused there. They lied about the warrant process. I mean, they got a warrant and they lied. They used the sealed dossier. They used Democrat and Oppo research to get it. It was extremely unethical. And the problem was that there wasn't really laws in place to make that criminal. So we've changed that. And the underlying bill that we're trying to get passed today, it makes 56 very, very serious and pretty extreme reforms to the program, and specifically really affect the FBI. So it prevent Crossfire Hurricane from happening at all. A lot of this bill is directed at what happened to Trump and making sure that can never, ever happen again. It decreases the number of FBI agents who can even access FISA queries by 90%. And so the FBI was really pissed about this, by the way. They did not like this, but we told them, like, too bad. I mean, you had too many abuses. There was too many cases where, like, somebody wanted to, search the database for their ex-girlfriend or something. You can't do that. It's illegal. And we're going to have criminal penalties in place now if you do those illegal things. We're going to make sure it's clear in law that it's illegal, and there's criminal penalties. There's 56 more of these. There's audits that are required. There's lawyers that have to be present if you even do a U.S. person query. If we have time, Brian, it's important for people to understand what I'm even talking about when I say a search and when I say a query. I think a lot of people, when they hear that, what they're hearing is, okay, so you put Brian's name into the database and all of a sudden you can read his Gmail account. That is absolutely not what's happening. It's not possible to do that. If you wanted to do that, you would need to go to a judge and get a warrant. It's more like you're running a license plate. It's more like you're running any number of databases that any cop would run when they're just, they suspect somebody of something. It's important for people to understand that.
Understood. But here's one thing, an example. So Bin Laden's over there in Afghanistan, and he calls me in New York. So right now, we just know he's calling an American. Without this program, you would not be able to find out who he's calling. And people listening right now, do you want to know who Bin Laden was calling?
Right.
It would be to our advantage to know. Now, the problem was with Carter Page, they were tapping his phone, and also George Papadopoulos. Were they also using that to surveil him?
I'm not sure I can speak. No, I don't think so on Papadopoulos. But look, and there's two. We're talking about two separate things. the example you have with bin Laden is a very good one, right? Like, wouldn't you want to know who the American is? Because what I remind people is, what do terrorists want to do? They don't just want to, like, train in Syria and Afghanistan. No, they want to train so that they can do an operation here in the homeland.
Right.
And in order to do an operation here in the homeland, they're going to have to talk to some Americans, and they're going to have to talk about Americans. They're going to have to talk about American places. And so if they're talking about a Starbucks, for instance, or maybe an airfield where you do pilot training, you're telling me that we can't even search the name of that training facility to see if other terrorists around the world are also talking about it? This warrant requirement would actually prevent you from doing it. And people were like, well, we'll just get a warrant. You could do it. You actually would not be able to get a warrant because simply talking about something is not probable cause to get a warrant. So when we say this kills the program, we mean it. It kills our ability to connect the dots from terrorists on the outside to the inside. And that's a very, very serious problem because, again, the only thing that matters about terrorism is the fact that they want to conduct terrorist activity here in the U.S. And so if you cut out that connected dots, if you cut out that line, that's the problem. The Carter Page issue, they really had a warrant. And so that's a different problem, and we address that in these reforms as well. The problem there is that they just lied about the information to the judges. Right. I mean, and there was no criminal penalties for it, so we're creating those criminal penalties. So two separate problems, and it's important to distinguish them.
True. Now, here's an example. So you think you have a warrant. You think you have enough to get a warrant. The judge says, I'm trusting all this evidence that you're giving me is right. There's nobody there representing somebody that you're looking to get a warrant on. So have you changed that process?
Yes. I mean, so as far as the Fisk court, I'm not really sure I understand your question.
So here's an example.
If you're trying to get a warrant on a foreigner in a foreign country, they obviously don't have a lawyer there, you know, defending their rights. Like that's kind of the whole point. But the process for a U.S. person would work just like it works any time you get a warrant, you know, for any search that a cop does. I'm not sure it's any different.
I want you, Christopher Ray said yesterday, cut 12.
Section 702 is indispensable in keeping Americans safe from a whole barrage of fast-moving foreign threats. It is crucial to identifying terrorists in the homeland working with or inspired by a rogues gallery of foreign terrorist organizations who have publicly called for attacks against our country.
So Christopher Ray saying, I need this. And then here's Congressman Mike Garcia. Tell me if you understand the sentiment. Cut 13.
I'll be honest with you, and this pains me to say this, but I don't trust you. I don't think that this is necessarily a funding problem that we have for your agency as much as a leadership problem. And you have held no one truly accountable for prior FISA abuses that we have all seen and recognized. You've stood relatively silent and passive about the biggest national security threat to our nation, that being our very open southern border. I give very little credence in either your ability to do this job or, frankly, lead the brave agents below you. And I don't trust you to protect us.
Do you trust him? And do you agree with Congressman Garcia?
I agree with both. So, I mean, because they're both saying totally different things. I mean, so Ray is correct that we absolutely need this program or people will die. Mike Garcia is also correct that we've lost trust in the FBI. Mike Garcia is a good friend of mine, and he agrees with everything I've told you already. We're going to vote exactly the same way today. So they're both correct. I don't trust the FBI, which is why I want these reforms. We have 56 serious reforms, and I looked it up as you were playing that, because your question was, is there going to be an independent lawyer, somebody to represent an American at a FISA court if that application is done? It was not that way before. These reforms would change that. So the answer to your question is yes. And that's really important. So, yes, I agree with Mike Garcia. They've lost our trust because they did too many things that were just outside the norms. And so these set of 56 reforms correct that. But you've got to correct really sensitive, complicated, important things with a scalpel, not a hammer. If you put the big debate here today is whether you have to have a warrant to even search the database. That's like saying you have to have a warrant every time you run a license plate or any number of databases that cops use every day to just connect dots and investigate things. And the other analogy I would say, if you give me the time, I don't know how much time we have.
No, we're doing good. We got three more minutes.
Okay, perfect. So here's the best analogy so that people understand what we're actually talking about. FISA is just a wiretap. It's just a wiretap, but on a foreigner. And it's not just a phone. It could be emails, text. Okay, so it's the modern age. It's a modern age wiretap. Now, just in the U.S., if you're wiretapped, Brian, and we're having this conversation, well, they have a warrant to wiretap you, but they also they're listening to what we're talking about. So now, I that collection that this what I'm saying right now is incidentally collected in that it is legally collected.
Yes,
and it can be acted upon. Now, it doesn't mean you can go to my inbox. It doesn't mean you can go through all my stuff unless I tell you something really bad. And okay, now you have probable cause to get it, but you still have to go get a warrant. There is no difference between that and FISA. The only difference is that FISA is a searchable database. So all of those wiretap conversations just happen to be stored and you can search for them.
Gotcha.
That is the only difference.
So it's going to pass today?
I think it'll definitely pass. I think what I'm more worried about is an amendment which requires the warrant for that search that I just described. Because if you do that, you kill the ability to search domestically and for very practical reasons.
Gotcha.
And it's complicated explaining why. And if you pass that, you kind of kill the program. And so I'm hoping that amendment fails. It needs to fail. It's Jayapal's. And by the way, it's the Progressive Caucus's amendment. This was mostly written by Democrats. And so, you know, we're being derided as rhinos for supporting this. Just to be clear, it is the progressives who agree with this, you know, with some of these guys in the Freedom Caucus on this. It's the progressives.
Gotcha.
That's the alliance.
Always great to talk to you. An impactful congressman every day. Congressman Dan Crenshaw, thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Hey, quick announcement. I want you to watch One Nation over the weekend. Got Glenn Greenwald's going to be joining us, Marco Rubio, Rick Prado on the slated terror threat, and Kennedy. Also, big announcement, Indianapolis, Indiana, June 29th, 2024, History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour. Go to Shelton Auditorium. Get tickets at BrianKilmeade.com.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.